I've been thinking about Paul Corley and Larry Payton today because it's late fall in Chile and Argentina, and they're going to be crossing over the Andes in a bus. And we wish them and pray for them good things. They'll be received, I'm sure, happily, both in Chile and in Mendoza. Some weeks back, Steve Huff called my attention and the attention of some others of us to an article in the Atlantic Monthly of April of this year. And so before I could do anything about it, Sid Latham bought a copy of the magazine. I think it was, I don't know how many dollars it was, but it sure saved me a lot of money. And then he made me a copy of it. And the title of the article was, Dan Quayle Was Right. And it's written by Barbara Defoe Whitehead, who had written in the Washington Post about a year ago on Mother's Day, or in connection with Mother's Day, an article that Marilyn Quayle had seen, called attention to her husband's speechwriters to, and it wound up being a part of that now famous speech in which he criticized one television show for having shown the unwed of the birth of a child out of wedlock. And so that same writer is the featured article in the April Atlantic Monthly, and it's so significant, I think, that someone would dare to write something like this, that it's almost tantamount to the young lad in the famous myth and fable who said, blurting it right out loud, the king doesn't have any clothes on. The cost of divorce and out-of-wedlock children to America. That's what this article is about. And I want to talk about it, not because I wish to give you a report on social research, but because I want you to understand why God's truth will always bring blessing to those who acknowledge it and live by it, and why it will always bring sadness to those who do not. The Bible reveals a God who hates divorce. That is exactly what he said in Malachi 2:16. I hate putting away. In the earlier verses, he said, you have covered the altar with the cries of your betrayed wives. Their tears have appealed to me, make it impossible for me to listen to you. You have been treacherous. You have been unfaithful. You have not fulfilled your commitment. In Matthew 19, corresponding parallel passages in Mark and in Luke, Jesus, quoting the statement in the second chapter of Genesis, says, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. And understanding, as he did, that what God had said, what Genesis said, contained an implicit truth, he said, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. God hates putting away. And the reason he hates putting away is because it does great harm to those who are partners in that relationship. It is a treacherous act when there is no solid biblical cause. It is the breaking of a promise, and it is consummately an act of selfishness. God hates adultery. It was a capital offense under the law of Moses. It's not a capital offense in our society. It's not any offense at all. In fact, in this society, it's sort of normal behavior. So that you must not think yourself being in any way out of the mainstream of moral steadfastness and uprightness if you commit adultery. That's not the biblical viewpoint. The Bible also reveals a God who hates cohabitation of men and women without the covenant of marriage. A young woman who came to marriage unable to display the evidence of her virginity, Deuteronomy 22:21, was stoned to death. If she was a daughter of a priest, she was burnt with fire. Leviticus 21. A man who lay with an unmarried woman not only had to pay a fine to her father, but he was compelled to marry her unless the father objected. And he was not allowed to put her away all the days of her life. Deuteronomy 22, 28, and 29. That's the same God who sent Jesus into the world to tell us about his love and to call us to serve him according to his righteous ways. What I want to tell you is that those laws, spiritual, moral laws, coming out of the mind of God, are just as unbreakable in the final analysis, just as inescapable in the final analysis as the laws of physics. No one ever suspects that we can violate the laws of physics and not pay a price. Gravity has a way of coming up and hitting you in the face when you attempt to fly into the face of it. When you take hold of the two ends of a completed circuit, an electrical circuit, it has a way of biting you. And I want to say that if you violate the moral laws of God, they're going to get to you because they don't work. They will destroy a society, but in our case, the thing we're most concerned about is they destroy a human being. They destroy that human being now. Now. You're not made for this. It doesn't fit. And as much as you may want to be as a result of some momentary passion or selfish urge to find happiness in some other way, you cannot. You cannot find happiness. And it's not because God is on the outside saying, you're not going to be happy because I'm going to see to it that you're not happy. I'm going to make you miserable. No. It's the way he made us that'll make us miserable. And it's the way he made us that will make a society that refuses to follow that moral, upright way miserable. 1 Corinthians 7:2 says, because of fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman have her own husband. And the preceding chapter, chapter 6 and verse 18, he says in simple language, flee fornication. Why is God so stringent in his laws about marriage? Why does he hate divorce? Why is God so concerned about fornication? It seems a small thing, especially to people in our time. Like taking a drink of water because you're thirsty. Eating a good meal because you're hungry. What's wrong with it? I believe one of the reasons that God is concerned about it is children. It is by the coming together of a man and a woman in the intimate association of marriage that children are born. Of course, you don't have to be married. And children can be conceived without the marriage. Not apart from a man and a woman. But the cost to the child, I believe, is one of the preeminent concerns that God has. He will protect these innocent, helpless children from the ravages of human selfishness. Ephesians 6:4 says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And 2 Corinthians 12:14, Paul says, the children are not to lay up for the parents. But the parents ought to lay up for the children. Marriage is a selfless union of two people. It is a covenant that protects and cares for the other. And when to that covenant are born children, then the partners in that covenant selflessly care for those children. Our society has the reputation of spoiling children rotten. Not a particularly selfless thing, by the way. Usually we spoil children for our own benefit, not for theirs. But the opposite is true. The opposite is true. We don't care that much in this society what happens to children. We can get stirred by some awful physical tragedy, and the tears will flow. But basically, this society is selfish as regards children. And that is exactly the theme of this article. I'll be glad to lend you my Xerox copy so you can save money. But the theme of this article is that we are a selfish society, and that what happens to children is little concern of ours. And we have, in order to protect ourselves in reality, tried to develop a series of myths that say children are not harmed by divorce. They are harmed by marriage. That is unhappy for the partners. Children are not harmed by being born out of wedlock, because single parent families are just as good, sometimes better, than two parent families. And we're able to ignore biological reality that says you can't have a child without two parents, whether they are married or not. That ought to give somebody a clue. But in this article, Ms. Whitehead, who is a research associate with the Institute of American Values, which is a nonpartisan Manhattan-based research organization devoted to the issues of family and civic well-being, she speaks out of her knowledge of social research, a shocking compilation of the body of social scientific evidence which reveals the tragic results in the lives of our children which have come from divorce and out of wedlock childbirth. In 1960, 5% of children in this country were born out of wedlock. 1990, 27%. The divorce rate has soared. 10 divorces for every 1,000 married couples in the 1950s and 60s. 23 per 1,000 in 1979, 21 per 1,000 in 1991. Fully one half of all marriages end in divorce. In the post-World War II generation, 80% of the children could expect to live in a family with two biological parents who were married to each other. 80%. In 1980, only 50% could expect to live their entire childhood in an intact family. Most American children will spend several years in a single-parent family. It's their destiny. Some will eventually live in a step-parent family, but because such marriages are even more unstable than intact biological families, an increasing number of children are destined to experience family breakup two or three times in childhood. Everybody knows that children love regularity and steadiness. As Mrs. Whitehead said, everybody knows that some children will ask for the same peanut butter and jelly sandwich every day, day after day after day after day. And we know they'll call on you to sing the same song day after day after day after day. They love steadfastness. They love stability. They prosper in that stability and that certitude. It's not a matter of living in the same place. It's the steadfastness of relationships. The consequences of all this is that one out of every four children growing up in the 1990s in this country will enter a step family. Children in families disrupted by divorce and out of wedlock birth do worse than children in intact families on several measures. And here's what she brings up. 6 times more likely to be poor and more likely to stay poor longer. That's the least consequential of all this study. We talk about children being poor in this country, directly attributable to the breakup of the family. When mothers have to struggle to take care of the children, and when the fathers don't help to take care of them. A 1998 study by the National Center for Health, children in one-parent families are 2 to 3 times as likely to have emotional and behavioral problems as children of two-parent families. Why should that surprise us? Biologically, it's supposed to be two. And they're not the same. They're not mirror images of each other. One is a father, one's a mother. One's male, one's female. And from each parent comes something significant. They are more likely to drop out of high school than two-parent family children, to get pregnant as teenagers, to abuse drugs, to be in trouble with the law. This is the study. They didn't have these studies back in the 1970s when everybody thought this was grand. But chickens come home to roost. Another thing that Ms. Whitehead says as a result of social research is the result of social research, contrary to popular belief, many children of divorce do not bounce back after divorce and remarriage. It was a popular feeling in the 1970s when divorce was rising, homes were breaking up and splitting apart like popcorn popping, that it would just be a momentary thing, like a headache or toothache, and then it'd be gone, and they would bounce back and be fine. But the children of one-parent or step-parent homes are less successful in two significant areas, according to all the research, in the matter of establishing loving relationships with others and the matter of their work. Judith Wallenstein, who's quoted in this particular article of the California Children Studies, and this is a study of children in California who have experienced divorce in their homes, and they started out thinking in 1971 that it would be a short-term kind of thing. But then they found out it wasn't going to be. 131 children in San Francisco whose parents divorced, and they expect a quick recovery. Interviews after 1 year, no better, doing worse. And Ms. Wallenstein said this, divorce is deceptive. Legally, it is a single event, but psychologically, it is a chain, sometimes a never-ending chain of events. Relocations and radically shifting relationships strung through time, a process that forever changes the lives of the people involved. Now, that's this nonpartisan social researcher who didn't have anything that was on her mind. She wasn't filled with some axes to grind. That's the result of the study. 5 years after divorce, more than a third of the children experienced moderate to severe depression. 10 years later, a significant number of the now young men and women appeared to be troubled, drifting, and underachievers. 15 years later, 30-ish adults were struggling to establish strong love relationships of their own. The long-term effects of divorce emerge when young adults are trying to make their own decisions about love, marriage, and family, Ms. Wallenstein said. And then she said, and I quote, "The child of divorce faces many additional psychological burdens in addition to the normative task of growing up." God said, "I hate divorce." Here's something specifically that happens. Father-child bonds severely and often irreparably damaged in disrupted families. The National Survey of Children says that only one child in six on the average saw his father as often as once a week in the past year. Close to half of those that are in this study did not see the father once in the last year. 10 years later, two-thirds report not having seen their father in a year. When asked to name adults that you most admire, only 20% of the single-parent family children named the father. In two-parent families, 52%. Not only that, but this was significant, that the relationship with the father changes. Sociologists Andrew Churkin and Frank Furstenberg, in their study of the broken family, came to this conclusion, that the fathers behave more like other relatives now that they are split off from the family. Instead of helping with homework or carrying out a project with children, they're more likely to take kids shopping, to the movies, out to dinner. Instead of providing steady advice and guidance, the divorced fathers become treat, quote-unquote, dads. Wallerstein says children whose fathers visit once or twice a week still feel rejected in their studies. Still feel rejected as a consequence of this experience. Of children who experience divorce at an early age, the father-child bond suffers the most. Three-fourths report poor relations with the father. A half have received psychological help. One-third have dropped out of high school, and a quarter of them have experienced high levels of emotional or behavioral distress by the time they're young adults. Long-term effects, not a short-term sort of situation. Now, we must understand that there will be out of these single-parent homes some good, stable, emotionally secure children. You know, in the early part of this century, there were one-parent families because the father died. Or maybe the mother died. But that didn't have the effect that divorce has, because they leave involuntarily. And children can deal with death, although we always said it's tough when your parent dies. Nobody ever thought it was good. Nobody ever thought this is a very viable alternative to two-parent families. It was always seen as a tragedy. But now, in this country, the breakup of the home is celebrated as if some new forms of family life are coming to the fore. And our ever-vital American society, always producing new variety, always characterized by freedom to choose your direction, is simply giving us, as it always has, diversity that comes together in unity. It is a myth.
There is no social research to support it. But the Bible has always said, God has always said, it is a tragedy.
And His law to men concerning it says, don't do that. Poverty, crime, and declining school performance. How we decry that in this country. Poverty is a big issue. Declining school performance, big issue. Always going down. And the crime getting so bad that the schools are really operated like penitentiaries, with police on constant duty. And they are so much involved with trying to help out the psychological problems of the students that they have no time to instruct. There's no question that schools in this country are not doing the job. But they can't do the job because it's impossible for the schools to do a job with the primary family, with the primary unit of society, the family. The primary school is not doing. More than one half the increase in child poverty in the 1980s is attributed to changes in family structure. 70% of all juveniles in the state reform institutions come from fatherless homes. And the great educational tragedy of our time, says Barbara Whitehead, is that many American children are failing in school not because they're intellectually or physically impaired, but because they're emotionally incapacitated. And no wonder. What's the American response to all this? We've made divorce quicker and easier to get than any other Western nation except Sweden. That's our record. We're so intelligent. We have greeted family breakup with a cry of triumph and jubilation. Freedom, happiness, fulfillment. This is America. Freedom to choose. In the same vein, we've shouted the praise of abortion, or the right to abortion, or the freedom to abort. We have also declared, and we declared this past weekend, that we must be free to choose the homosexual way. Gay is good. Gay is fine. We have closed it with the language of progress. Nuclear family, corrupt. It's the old. It's the past. The new family ideas are the wave of the future. Our diversity is our strength. It's nonsense. But the worst thing of all, and I want to tell you, this is where it strikes the heart of the whole of the gospel, and that is the selfishness of it. In the mid-1940s, a book on divorce asserted, children are entitled to affection and association of two parents, not one. Simple as that. 30 years later, another popular divorce book said, a two-parent home is not the only emotional structure within which a child can be happy and healthy. The parents who take care of themselves will be best able to take care of their children. Did you get that? How do you bless others? Take care of yourself first. That is not just the current approach of a few Americans. It is not just the current approach of a small minority of Americans. It is not just the current approach of an insignificant minority of Americans. It is an approach of a significant part, if not the majority of Americans today, that I must be fulfilled, no matter what it costs others. Indeed, and in fact, my happiness is critical to their happiness, and it comes before theirs. By the mid-1970s, studies indicated 3/4 of Americans said it was not wrong for a woman to have a child outside of marriage. Who cares about the child? Who cares about the child? And it's not the stigma. Years ago, it was the stigma. It was tough to be born out of wedlock in the United States. Because there was a social stigma, and unfortunately, usually it sticks with the child instead of the parent. But in this case today, they don't care about the children or the consequence to them. Fewer than one half of all adult Americans today regard the idea of sacrifice for others as a positive moral virtue. Now, there's an expression of selfishness. Fewer than one half of our citizens believe that sacrifice for others is a positive moral virtue. That's a mistake in their mind. And we see examples of it. I must serve myself. Hollywood celebrates divorce. It's nothing. They also celebrate out-of-wedlock children. It is nothing at all to see a recent notice about two people had a child and they're not married. How happy some unwed father is about the fact that his girlfriend had a baby. It's on the front page. It's in all the gossip magazines, but not because it's something that's tragic or something that's unwholesome, because it's news. 34 million Americans watched Murphy Brown in her dramatized birth pangs to give birth to a child out of wedlock. Goodbye to apple pie. We've come to a new situation in our country. There is a book entitled Dinosaur's Divorce, A Guide for Changing Families, that says to the children, this is a book for children. to counsel them about divorce, a guide to changing families.
Be prepared to give up something. The children. To the parents, nothing. To the parents, be happy. To the parents, do what you need to do. Find a way out. Life is too short to have to sacrifice anything of your happiness. But to the children, be prepared to give up something. They're being called on to sacrifice.
There's a comment on the book in Miss Whitehead's article said, be sympathetic, understanding, respectful, and polite to confused, unhappy parents. There's something about that that is sick to the core. That's enough about Dan Quayle's right. I want to have a little time to talk to you about what's right in this thing. Marriage, as God intended it and as He demands that it be, and we'll pay a price in this life and beyond it when we fail to accept His rather stringent marriage law. And that is that to put away a mate except for the cause of fornication, sexual immorality, and to marry another commits adultery. Indeed, to put away a mate for any other cause than sexual immorality is to make your mate an adulteress or adulterer. Matthew 5:32. There is no other cause for divorce that is acceptable to God except marital infidelity. And when there is a remarriage in that case, then that is adultery, said the Scripture. And the disciples listening to Jesus say this, say if that's the case of a man and his wife, it's expedient not to marry. They got the message. They realized that they were dealing with something very stringent. We need to realize that fact. It is an unselfish union. You're not in this to be happy. You're in it to make somebody else happy. You're in it to serve somebody else. And thus the spirit of the 5th chapter of Ephesians and the 6th chapter of Ephesians. 5:21 says we're to subject ourselves one to another in the fear of Christ. That simply means that I must serve the other individual. My happiness must be secondary to their happiness. What do we think Jesus was talking about in the 2nd chapter of Philippians when he says that each of us should look to the things of the other and not to our own things? What he's saying is, be more concerned about others. And in the marriage relationship, certainly. The husband must serve the wife, and the wife must serve the husband. In terms of meeting the needs of the other. And as I've said many, many times, the way to get love is to be a lover. And to be a lover means to be unselfish, and to be unselfish means to sacrifice yourself for the sake of the other individual. So the fundamental rule of the marriage relationship is, you must sacrifice yourself for the other. In fact, he says in this chapter, you must love your wife as your own body. He says more emphatically, you must love your wife as Christ loved the church, which says you must be willing to sacrifice yourself for her. Some of us are not willing to sacrifice anything. We are not going to bear anything. The moment our own self-interest in any sense is compromised, we want out. I've had more than one spouse tell me when I give such counsel in the Word of God, you don't understand. If you were where I am, you could not tolerate this. And I may say to them, you may be right, but I'd still be wrong. And you're wrong. I mean, the gospel shouts it. Jesus dying on the cross, saying, come follow me. Loving other people, giving himself up absolutely for their sake, even they didn't deserve it. And in this marriage relationship, we're going to have to learn the lesson of selfless love. And then we come to the parent. Not only must husband and wife serve each other in selflessness in this marriage relationship, but parents need to serve the children. Now, there is a great myth going around that we get children so we can be happy. The children are to make us happy. Is that right? Well, that's what we brought to the marriage. Getting married is to make us happy. It's to make me happy. And you're already off on the wrong track. And if you have the idea that having children is to make you happy, then you're already going in the wrong direction. Having children is a sacred trust.
It is taking these innocent ones who have eternal spirits and being responsible to give them the kind of nurture that will enable them at last to be happy, not only here, and not merely here, but hereafter. And so in the language of 6, verse 4, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them in the chastening and admonition of the Lord. That just simply means that you're going to have a plan in mind here. A lot of parents have no plan in mind for their children. They just put out the fires if the fires get started. I speak metaphorically. When trouble comes, they try to handle the trouble. But plan? Dream? And if the dream is there, it's a dream of what? Dream of worldly glory? My child will be so important that I'll be known as the father or the mother of so-and-so. And I'll bask in the glory that my child's going to achieve. What an unselfish dream. I want my son to play pro football. I want my son to be this magnificent scientist. I want my daughter to be this wonderfully popular young lady that everybody in Louisville knows, or wherever I happen to be. This is a dream of selfless sobriety. It is pathetic. And with that kind of dream for your children, to make money, to succeed academically, and that's the first and only consideration, I can tell you what's going to happen to the spiritual concerns. They're going to go straight down the drain. We need, as parents, according to this exhortation by Paul, to communicate to our children from their first conscious moment that what we want for them is that they be the servants of God, that they love the God that gave them life, and let us have them for a little while. And that they serve the one to whom they owe everything. And our task will be somehow to turn them over to the influence of that God so that he can continue a process that we ourselves have begun. But we've got to know that that's our dream. Is that your dream? Is that dream secured in your mind? You've got some other dream for these children. The nurture and admonition of the Lord. The Lord's purpose in this thing must be ever apparent in what we say to the children. I tell you, the biggest cost of all that is you're going to have to live like that yourself. You're going to have to live that dream before these children. They have got to know that for you, loving and serving God is more important than anything else ever. I mean, it's everything else, not even second. It's way down the line. And then to bring the Spirit of that Lord to the task of training them. The purpose of God must be exactly what we want that child to achieve, and we must bring the Spirit of the Lord, selfless Spirit, reasonable Spirit, genuine Spirit to the rearing and guiding of children. And it means we're going to have sacrifice. Parents say, I ain't having no fun. Well, tough luck. Did you think that's what life was about? Life's about helping people, living for other people. If you want to have any fun, you're going to get it as a byproduct of that. You're not going to have much fun after the way you've trained your children, makes them materialistic, causes them to get married with such little concept of commitment to God that marriage breaks up, and now the grandchildren stand at your house. Or you watch them far, far away and see their lives going to smash and not a thing in the world you can do about it. And you see all this unhappiness and you wonder what went wrong. I'm not telling you tonight that it can't go wrong even with the best effort you make, because people have their own free will. But I do believe most earnestly that the rule is that if you train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old he will not depart from it. That's the rule. And I'm glad that that's the rule. I'm glad there's hope as we do that. But I absolutely can tell you that if we do not do what we need to do in terms of our rearing children selflessly, that the consequences are going to be most unhappy. Well, that's sort of a severe chastening kind of a lesson. But what it says is, when you don't do the will of God, you pay for it. When a society does not do the will of God, that society pays for it. Not in hell, but now. And we just began to pay the price.
Because all these children come out of these broken homes, all busted up themselves, trying to form some other unions. It's not just one marriage they go through. They go through several. As one fellow said, as he wrote a book entitled it, Marriage, Divorce, and Remarriage, and this is social analyst, this fellow's not theological. He said it should have been called cohabitation, likely marriage, divorce, more cohabitation, probably another marriage. Endless parade of boyfriends or girlfriends. Endless uncertainties. Heaped upon innocent children whose lives are massacred as a consequence. And it's no wonder to me that God says, I hate putting away. And in closing, I want to say this. Adultery is awful. It is a terrible betrayal. And never having had to experience it in a relationship, I would imagine it would take the best you had to respond to the appeal of a guilty mate who says, please forgive me. It would take Christ in you, deep within you, to be able to do that. Because all that trust that's been shot down on account of this betrayal has to be rebuilt again. But if it's possible, I would say to you, if it's possible to rebuild that marriage for those children, it will be worth it. The evidence is that even a marriage that's not working too well is better than blowing the whole thing apart and exposing the children to that heartache. We just have been living with a lot of myths that have sort of covered up the reality of our moral and spiritual failure in this country. And sooner or later, our selfishness will come back to haunt us. I'm talking to people who are not a part, by and large, of all this mess. But are we not willing to face the fact that what's going on out there sooner or later comes in to haunt us in here? That we will have to deal with this, and we will have to deal with the problems that create it, and the reason that Christ is the answer to so many problems, to all problems at last, is because he teaches us the selfless way. And I know it looks hard at the beginning, it looks impossible at the beginning, but at last it's the only way that brings the happiness that we want, the good result for our children and the good result for ourselves. So I appeal to you, let's set a standard of righteousness in this country, some light in this world, and show people how you can sacrifice yourself for the needs of others and be glad about it and not resent it, but recognize this as a part of growing up in him who is head, even Christ, the fullness of the measure of the stature of the Lord. Parents, keep that dream in your head for your children. And you sacrifice whatever you've got to sacrifice to achieve that dream. Doesn't cost money. It costs moral and spiritual courage. It costs true, selfless love. It takes time. It takes prayer. It takes teaching and nurturing day in and day out over time. But one of these days, I guarantee you, when you see that child standing up strong and earnest and tall, spiritually speaking, whether he or she attains to some level of achievement in this world is going to make less importance to you as the days pass, and the thing that's going to be important is what their relationship to God is. Because that's what's going to be important to you. And it's going to be most important in your mind for everybody else that you love. We'll let that stand for itself. Time is exhausted. If you're not a Christian, if you haven't made life's most significant and important and necessary commitment, because you have decided, like a certain prodigal son, that the way to be happy is to have your freedom. Or the way to be happy is money. Or the way to be happy is not have anybody tell you what to do. and have a continual party. That's the thing that puts you in the pig pen. And the Lord doesn't want you in the pig pen. And if that's where you are tonight, if that's where you're on your way to tonight, then I'm pleading with you to change your course and come back to your Father's house, where you'll be loved and cared for in His inimitably wise and gracious way, so that your life hereafter is going to be one of true and ultimate happiness and peace and joy. That's the gospel's attraction. It's the invitation of a God who cares about you. And you attain that by believing in Jesus and by being baptized in His name out of a genuine, penitent faith. And we invite you to choose to do that while we're standing and singing.